This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of TKA periprosthetic fracture from the recon section on orthobullets.com. Categories of TKA periprosthetic fractures include location and timing. With respect to location, types of TKA periprosthetic fractures include distal femur periprosthetic fractures, proximal tibia periprosthetic fracture, and patellar fractures. With respect to timing, these can be either intraoperative or postoperative. In the intraoperative setting, the medial femoral condyle fracture is the most common. General risk factors for TKA periprosthetic fractures include poor bone quality, mechanical stress risers, and neurological disorders. With respect to poor bone quality, specific examples include age, steroid use, rheumatoid arthritis, and stress shielding. With respect to mechanical stress risers, specific examples include screw holes, local osteolysis, and stiffness. And finally, with respect to neurological disorders, specific examples include epilepsy, Parkinson's disease, cerebellar ataxia, myasthenia gravis, polio, and cerebral palsy. Now, let's talk about distal femur periprosthetic fractures in a bit more detail. The incidence is about 0.3% to 2.5%. Fracture-specific risk factors include anterior femoral notching, which is debatable, mismatch of the elastic modulus between the metal implant and the femoral cortex, and rotationally constrained components. As far as classification systems, the Lewis and Rohrbach is most commonly used, but other ones include the Near and Associates classification from 1967, the DiGiola and Rubach classification from 1991, the Chen and Associates classification from 1994, and the Su and Associates classification of supracondylar fractures of the distal femur. The Near and Associates classification from 1967 is divided into three types. Type 1 is non-displaced that has less than 5 millimeters of displacement and or less than 5 degrees of angulation. Type 2 is displaced greater than 1 centimeter, and this is also subdivided into types 2A and types 2B. Types 2A is displaced greater than 1 centimeter with lateral femoral shaft displacement, while type 2B is displaced greater than 1 centimeter with medial femoral shaft displacement. And type 3 is displaced and comminuted. Moving on to the DiGioia and Rubach classification from 1991, this is divided into three groups. Group 1 is extra-articular, non-displaced, that is less than 5 millimeters and or less than 5 degrees of angulation. Group 2 is also extra-articular, but it's displaced, defined as greater than 5 millimeters and or greater than 5 degrees of angulation. And group 3 has a loss of cortical contact or is angulated 10 degrees. This may have an intercondylar or T-shaped component. The Chen and Associates classification from 1994 is divided into two types. Type 1 is non-displaced, and type 2 is displaced and or comminuted. The Lewis and Rohrbach classification from 1997, which is most commonly used, is divided into three types. Type 1 is non-displaced, with the component intact. Type 2 is displaced with the component intact, and type 3 is displaced with the component loose or failing. Finally, the Su and Associates classification of supracondylar fractures of the distal femur are divided into three types. Type 1 has a fracture that is proximal to the femoral component. In type 2, the fracture originates at the proximal aspect of the femoral component and extends proximally. And in type 3, any part of the fracture line is distal to the upper edge of the anterior flange of the femoral component. Treatment of TKA periprosthetic fractures can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management involves casting or bracing. The indications for this include non-displaced fractures with a stable prosthesis. Operative options include an antegrade intramedullary nail, retrograde intramedullary nail, ORIF with a fixed-angle device, revision to a long-stem prosthesis, or a distal femoral replacement. An antegrade intramedullary nail is indicated for supracondylar fractures proximal to the femoral component, or a SU type 1. A retrograde intramedullary nail has some technical considerations. For example, at least 2 distal interlocking screws must be used. You should use the end cap to lock the most distal screw if available. Keep in mind that the femoral component may cause the starting point to be more posterior than normal and lead to hyperextension at the fracture site. And finally, the nail must be inserted deep enough, not protruding, to abrade on the patella/patellar component. Indications for a retrograde intramedullary nail include an intact/stable prosthesis with an open box design to accommodate the nail. Other indications include fracture proximal to the femoral component, that is a Sue type 1, or a fracture that originates at the proximal femoral component and extends proximally, that is a Sue type 2. ORIF with a fixed angle device is indicated for an intact slash stable prosthesis. It's also indicated for a Lewis Rohrbach 2 or Sue types 1 or 2 that are unable to accommodate an intramedullary device. Other indications include fracture distal to the flange of the anterior femoral component or a Sue type 3. This has been a tested indication in the past, so I'll say it again. ORIF with a fixed angle device is indicated for a fracture distal to the flange of the anterior femoral component or a Sue type 3. As far as techniques, you can use a condylar buttress plate that is non-locking, but keep in mind this does not resist varus collapse. A locking supracondylar slash periarticular plate can be used, in which polyaxial screws allow the screws to be directed into the best bone before locking into the plate and can avoid the femoral component. And finally, a blade plate slash a dynamic condylar screw is another technique that can be used. However, it's difficult to get adequate fixation around PS implants. Complications of ORIF with a fixed angle device include non-union and malunion. Non-union has an increased risk in plating via an extensile lateral approach compared with a submuscular approach. Malunion has an increased risk with a minimally invasive approach. Moving on to a revision to a long stem prosthesis, this is indicated for a loose femoral component or in a Lewis Rohrbach type 3 or a Sue type 3 with poor bone stock. Finally, a distal femoral replacement is indicated in elderly patients with loose Sue type 3 or malpositioned components and poor bone stock. Advantages of this include immediate weight bearing and decreased operative time of the procedure. Now let's talk about tibial periprosthetic fractures in a bit more detail. These have an incidence of 0.4% to 1.7%. Fracture-specific risk factors include prior tibial tubercle osteotomy, component loosening, component malposition, and insertion of long-stem tibial components. The classification of tibial periprosthetic fractures include the Felix and Associates classification of periprosthetic fractures of the tibia associated with the total knee arthroplasty. This is divided into four types. Type 1 is fracture of the tibial plateau. Type 2 is fracture adjacent to the tibial stem. Type 3 is fracture of the tibial shaft distal to the component. And type 4 is fracture of the tibial tubercle. Treatment of tibial periprosthetic fractures can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management includes casting or bracing, which is indicated for non-displaced fractures with a stable prosthesis. Operative options include ORIF or long-stem revision prosthesis. An ORIF is indicated for unstable fractures with a stable prosthesis. A long-stem revision prosthesis is indicated for displaced fractures with a loose tibial component. Now let's talk a bit more about patellar periprosthetic fractures. These have an incidence of 0.2% to 21% in a resurfaced patella and 0.05% in an unresurfaced patella. Fracture-specific risk factors include patellar osteonecrosis, asymmetric resection of the patella, inappropriate thickness of the patella, and implant-related risk factors like a central single peg implant, uncemented fixation, metal backing on the patella, and an inset patellar component. The classification of patellar periprosthetic fractures is the Goldberg classification, which has four types. Type 1 is a fracture not involving the implant slash cement interface or quadriceps mechanism. Type 2 is a fracture involving the implant slash cement interface and or quadriceps mechanism. Type 3 is subdivided into two types, type A and type B, where type A is an inferior pole fracture with patellar ligament rupture, and type B is an inferior pole fracture without patellar ligament rupture. And finally, type 4 are all types with fracture dislocations. Treatment of a patellar periprosthetic fracture can be non-operative or operative. Non-operative management involves casting or bracing in extension, and the indications include stable implants with an intact extensor mechanism, as well as for non-displaced fractures. Operative indications include a loose patellar component, as well as an extensor mechanism disruption. Operative techniques include ORIF with or without component revision, partial patellectomy with tendon repair, patellar resection, arthroplasty, and fixation, as well as total patellectomy. However, indications for each of these have not been clearly defined. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, A 60-year-old woman presents for follow-up 2 weeks after right total knee arthroplasty. She complains of significant anterior knee pain after fall from standing onto a flexed knee. On physical exam, her passive range of motion is 0 to 120 degrees, and she is stable to varus and valgus stress. She is able to achieve full extension with active range of motion, though she is experiencing severe pain. A lateral radiograph of the knee demonstrates a transverse periprosthetic patella fracture without component loosening. What is the most appropriate next step? And the choices are 1. Non-operative management with long leg cast. 2. Closed treatment with immediate active range of motion. 3. Removal of patellar component with early active range of motion. 4. Open reduction and internal fixation of patella with wire or screw fixation. And 5. Extensor mechanism repair with Achilles allograft and revision of the patella. So the appropriate treatment for a transverse periprosthetic patella fracture with an intact extensor mechanism is closed treatment and immobilization in a long leg cast. Periprosthetic patella fracture after total knee arthroplasty is rare, with an incidence of 0.68 to 5.2%, and is overwhelmingly secondary to a traumatic mechanism. Risk factors include excessive patella resection, use of cementless components, and elevated BMI. Broadly, the treatment algorithm for periprosthetic patella fracture depends on the stability of the implant and the involvement of the extensor mechanism. Ortikera and Berry classified periprosthetic patella fractures as intact extensor mechanism with a well-fixed implant, which is type 1, extensor mechanism disruption with either loose or stable implant, which is a type 2, or intact extensor mechanism with a loose implant, which is a type 3. Generally, fractures associated with component loosening or extensor mechanism injuries, type 2 and type 3, require revision surgery and often yield poor results. Type 1 fractures are successfully managed non-operatively. So again, the correct answer to this question is 1. Non-operative management with a long leg cast. Nam et al. Reviewed the management of extensor mechanism complications in total knee arthroplasty. They report excellent results in type 1 periprosthetic patella fractures managed non-operatively, with only one failure in 37 patients. They propose a treatment algorithm based upon fracture pattern, whether it's transverse versus vertical, component fixation, and extensor mechanism integrity. Type 1 injuries with transverse fractures should be immobilized in long leg casts, whereas type 1 injuries with vertical fractures are more stable and can benefit from early active range of motion. Catino et al. Similarly review the outcomes of periprosthetic patella fractures. They report a 50% complication rate and a 20 to 40% reoperation rate for type 2 and type 3 injuries, even with anatomic reductions. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following is true regarding intraoperative fractures during total knee arthroplasty? And the choices are 1. They occur more commonly in cruciate retaining total knee replacements. 2. Fractures of the medial femoral condyle are the most common fracture type. 3. Fractures of the patella are the most common fracture type. 4. Most can be treated without additional fixation at the time of surgery. And 5. Tibial fractures are more common than femoral fractures. So fractures of the medial femoral condyle are the most common type of intraoperative fracture during a total knee arthroplasty, making 2 the correct answer to this question. Intraoperative fractures during total knee replacement are rare, but usually requiring alterations in surgical technique once they occur. The most common time for fractures to occur is during exposure and bone preparation, with fracture during trialing being the next most common. Fractures occur more commonly in posterior cruciate substituting designs, likely due to the box cut. Osteoporosis, female gender, chronic steroid use, advanced age, rheumatoid arthritis, and neurologic disorders are risk factors for postoperative fracture, but are also thought to be risk factors for intraoperative fractures. Alden et al. Reviewed 17,389 primary TKAs and found an intraoperative fracture rate of 0.39%. Of the 67 fractures, 49 were femur fractures, 18 were tibia fractures, and none were patella fractures. They recommend careful surgical technique in patients at high risk for fracture to avoid such a complication. Sharkey et al. Reviewed 10 intraoperative femoral fractures during primary cementless total hip arthroplasty. They matched these with 20 patients who did not have this complication. At follow-up, there were no differences found between the two groups. Moving on to the next question. All of the following are risk factors for postoperative total knee arthroplasty periprosthetic supracondylar femur fractures except, and the choices are 1. Rheumatoid arthritis, 2. Parkinson's disease, 3. Chronic steroid therapy, 4. Revision knee arthroplasty, and 5. Male gender. So rheumatoid arthritis, Parkinson's disease, chronic steroid therapy, osteopenia, and female gender have all been found to be risk factors for postoperative periprosthetic supracondylar femur fractures. Male gender has not been found to be a risk factor, making number 5 the correct answer to this question. Su et al. Discuss risk factors for supracondylar periprosthetic femoral fractures, which include rheumatoid arthritis, neurologic disorders such as Parkinson's disease, chronic steroid therapy, and revision knee arthroplasty. Analysis of the Mayo Clinic Joint Registry by Berry found that females are actually at increased risk of postoperative periprosthetic fracture, likely due to the increased incidence of osteoporosis. There is controversy regarding anterior cortical notching and increased risk for periprosthetic fracture. Lesh et al. Performed a biomechanical study on the consequences of anterior femoral notching, using cadaveric-matched femora with and without full-thickness anterior cortex defects above TKA implants. They found that notching decreased both bending and torsional strength in the supracondylar region of the femur. They also found that fracture orientation differed between the two groups following the application of a bending load. Ritter et al. In a series of 670 total knee arthroplasties, of which 27% had notching of less than 3 millimeters, only 2 patients sustained supracondylar femoral fractures, one with notching, one without. The authors argued that remodeling and stress redistribution around the implant accounted for the low incidence of fractures despite a high incidence of intraoperative notching. And the last question for this topic, a 73-year-old female underwent total knee arthroplasty 10 years ago. She sustained a proximal tibial shaft periprosthetic fracture after a ground-level fall. Radiograph showed that the fracture involves the tibial component stem with loosening of the tibial component. Which of the following is the most appropriate treatment? And the choices are 1. Open reduction and internal fixation of the tibia, 2. External fixation, 3. Intramedullary rod fixation, 4. Revision with a long-stem tibial component that bypasses the fracture, and 5. Fracture bracing. So revision with a long-stem tibial component that bypasses the fracture is an appropriate treatment for tibial shaft fractures at the level of the implant with evidence of implant loosening. Hajdukowicz et al. Present a level 5 review that states a periprosthetic fracture that involves the stem of a component with evidence of loosening requires revision. The most common revision type is with a long-stem press-fit component that bypasses the fracture by at least 2 cortical diameters. Kim et al. Present a level 5 review including a classification system and treatment algorithms. They state that type 2 fractures are defined as those occurring with good bone stock and being reducible, but have loose or malpositioned components. They recommend that these fractures are treated by revision arthroplasty. That's all for this review about TKA periprosthetic fractures. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.